I want to share some stuff in 10 and 11. I've been able to spiritually understand these steps more in the last 2 years than ever before, and in particular in the last year. And that's what I want to share with you. I hear in meetings that 10 and 11 are maintenance steps. They are not maintenance steps for me at all. They are growth steps, tremendous growth steps. So let's go through and take a look at what happens. Now, it says this thought brings us to step 10. What do you think the book means when it says this thought? The thought is those promises will materialize if I continue to make my amends. That's the thought. So, when we look at the instructions in the big book, the day that I got through with all my cards and I was going to start making the first amend was the day my sponsor said, come on over to the house and we're going to sit down and go over the instructions on the 10th and 11th step. And the reason is, we're going to read in the 10th step, the instruction is, I commence this way of living as I vigorously clean up the past. I was at a meeting not long ago, and a person was out making amends, and we talked a little bit afterwards, and I was explaining to them how I used 10 and 11 to go make amends, and they said, my sponsor told me not to do anything with 10 until I was done with amends. I was flabbergasted. I can't conceive of making amends without using 10 and 11 to get the power to go make the amends, let alone live in the world. So let's look at what this step says. This thought, the idea of finishing amends, brings me to step 10, which suggests that I continue to take personal inventory, fourth step, and continue to set right any new mistakes as I go along. I vigorously commenced this way of living as I cleaned up the past. That's the instruction to start the 10th step the day you start your amends. Look at the next sentence and ask yourself how often we hear this as a topic for meetings in AA. I have entered the world of the Spirit. Remember I told you in the second step we commence spiritual growth. In the fifth step we may have had certain spiritual beliefs. Now we have the spiritual experience. Well, when I get to the 10th step having done this work, I've now entered the world of the Spirit. Why don't we talk about, you want to really screw up an AA meeting? The next one you go to and the chairman says, you have a topic. Yes, I have a topic. I'm not there yet, but I'm curious. In the 10th step, it says we've entered the world of the Spirit. Yes, Spirit. I'd like to hear from some people in this room what their experience is with having entered the world of the Spirit. And watch the meeting change to fear or something. Think about it. Look at the next sentence. It says we've entered the world of the Spirit. My next function is to grow, circle the word grow, is to grow in understanding of effectiveness. Is it possible that I'm supposed to grow in understanding and effectiveness of what it's like to have entered the world of the Spirit? Think about that. Is it possible, the book is suggesting, that my next function is to grow in understanding of effectiveness of what it's like to have entered the world of the Spirit? This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for my lifetime. It says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Well, that's my fourth step, isn't it? When these crop up, that implies they're going to crop up. I ask God at once to remove them. That's what I do in step 6 and 7. I discuss them with someone immediately, step 5, and make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone, step 9. Then I resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Now, in the next few paragraphs, we're going to read about what I call the 10-step promises. You do not hear the 10-step promises talked about much in the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous either. It was told to me by several people who have been doing this work a lot longer than me. The reason we don't hear that is because most people in AA have never finished all their amends, so they don't have any experience with the 10-step promises. Is that true? I don't know. Look at your own experience. Here's one of them. Do I have the power to operate with love and tolerance of others is my code. And this next sentence I absolutely love. And I have ceased fighting anything or anyone, dash, even alcohol, and alcohol is last. I have ceased fighting
anything or anyone. The IRS, the woman or man that wants to leave, the financial difficulties, the physical ailments. I have ceased fighting anything or anyone, because in the world of the Spirit, there is no room to fight anything or anyone. There's just love and service. Now, second step talks about, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. Look at the next sentence. For by this time, sanity will have been returned. I will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, I recoil from liquor as from a hot flame. I react sanely and normally, and I find this happens automatically. Automatically means I don't have to think about it. I will see my new attitude toward liquor has been given me without any thought or effort on my part. Now, I remember asking about that question. I said to Don, wait a minute. I worked my butt off in these steps. What do you mean? There's no thought or effort on my part. He said, you didn't go through these steps to have a changed attitude toward liquor. I said, my God, you're right, I didn't. And it told me it was given to me. It says it just comes. That is the miracle of it. I am not fighting it, neither am I avoiding temptation. I feel as though I've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I have not even swore off. Look at the next sentence. Instead, the problem has been removed. We talked earlier about the power of choice. In the world of the Spirit, there is no more the power to choose booze than there is to stop breathing. The idea of operating in the world of the Spirit and drinking alcohol cannot coexist in the same place. You see what the book's trying to tell me? The problem's been removed in the 10th step as a result of all this other work, and I've entered the world of the Spirit. It says, it does not exist for me. The problem has been removed. It does not exist for me. What problem? Craving of the body, obsession of the mind, spirituality, the root of my problem, all those things. They've been removed. They don't exist for me anymore. And I now operate in the world of the Spirit. I'm neither cocky nor am I afraid. That is our experience. It says that is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Now I get a warning. It is easy. This is the only time the big book tells you anything is easy, and it's in the form of a deadly warning. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on my laurels. Here's what laurels are. Anything that you've ever done up through this minute that you think has something to do with keeping you sober, that's laurels. I'm headed for trouble if I do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. I am not cured of alcoholism. What I really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Now that sentence implies something to me. If I'm given a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, what if I don't do anything to maintain my spiritual condition? Common sense says I probably may not be given the daily reprieve. Remember, we looked at something about the obsession of the mind. I am unable at certain times to remember the consequences of the last drink. You see, there may be some people in AA who have a luxury of taking a day off from prayer or meditation. I am not one of them. That might be the day when I go get drunk. See what I'm saying? See what the book's trying to speak to us about? Every day is a day when I must carry the vision of God's will into all my activities. And now I get a prayer. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. There is a difference between God's will and the vision of God's will. We all know God's will. Don't lie. Don't cheat. Don't steal. Treat people with respect. Be kind, courteous, all the Boy Scout stuff. We know God's will. There's a huge difference between God's will and the vision of God's will for us. So what is the instruction in the book? Here's what it is. If I have to be at appointment A at 9 o'clock, I say a prayer before I go in there. God, how may I best serve thee? Let thy will, not mine, be done. And then I got another appointment at 10:30. And before I go into the appointment at 10:30, I say a prayer. God, how may I best serve thee? Let thy will, not mine, be done. It says, before I begin all my activities. So as I move from one activity to another, I say a prayer. Goes on to say, these are thoughts which must go with me constantly. I can exercise my willpower along this line all I wish. It is the proper use of the will. Look what the 10 steps telling us. Sanity's been restored. I've been given the miracle of a changed attitude toward alcohol. No thought or effort on my part. The problem's been removed. It doesn't exist. I'm given a warning about staying in fit spiritual condition. I'm given a tool to stay in fit spiritual condition. And now it's telling me I can trust my will because it's aligned with God. Look at what the first and second step told us. You see the movement that's happened from the first step to where we are right now as a result of this process? These things we call the steps done out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Next paragraph's got some interesting things in it. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. You want to try a little exercise sometime? If the book's saying much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, direction from Him who has all knowledge and power, you got a little free time, nothing to do, go back through your book and highlight everything where the book tells you how to get strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. Now another little warning. If I've carefully followed directions, I have begun to sense the flow of the Spirit into us. Remember I said we must gain access to God and then come to believe? The book time and time again talks about the power of God flowing into me. To some extent, I become God conscious. I have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. Now I want you to think about something. We all know what the first major five senses are, don't we? Seeing, hearing, taste, touch, smell. Is it possible the book is suggesting to me that I can take the world of the Spirit, my conscious relationship with God, and it can now be a sixth sense that I can use in this world just like sight? Absolutely. That's exactly what it means. My relationship with God, the power, the peace, the sense of direction and happiness now becomes a sixth sense to me just like vision, just like hearing, just like taste, just like touch. And do you know what I found? My ego takes my God-given senses like sight and uses them to separate me from you. It does stuff like this, hearing. I go into meetings of AA and I hear Mildred Road Solution. You know what my keen alcoholic mind says? Don't want to talk to that person. They're full of shit. What did I just do? I just separated myself from somebody that I could maybe be helpful to. Here's what I found. When I'm in touch with my sixth sense, it controls all my others. And now I can use them like God intended me to use them. Everything in my life is a direct offshoot as a result of living in the world of the Spirit, my personal relationship with God. Now I can make better use of hearing, seeing, touch, smell, taste. Wow. And what do we hear in AA about the 10th step? Well, the 10th step is about continuing to take personal inventory and making amends. Give me a break. The 10th step is about entering the world of the Spirit and growing in understanding and effectiveness about what it's like to operate in the world of the Spirit, bring it down here to move out there. That's what the 10th step is about. You see what I said about I can't imagine making amends without using the tools of the world of the Spirit to do that with? Imagine taking your relationship with God and all the tools of the 10th step and going making amends. You think making amends is any big deal? No, it's not any big deal. My relationship with God can become a sixth sense that controls all their senses, and from the time I get up till the time I go to bed, allow me to operate in that world out there and demonstrate the two things that Dr. Bob said this whole deal is about and every other spiritual book says, love and service. 10th step is just a little bit more than continuing to take personal inventory. How free you want to get? I told a friend this the other day. What you all call, I think, the real world, for the most part, is an illusion to me anymore. For me, the real world's the world of the Spirit. The book told us this, and we agnostic, that this world that we call the real world is an illusion. We look at a table and say it's a table. No, it's not. It's a mass of electrons. Is it possible to take the world of the Spirit and have it dominate everything that I do, all my personal relationships, my career, my physical health, everything? Yeah, I believe that's possible. And is it possible that everything is in fact an offshoot of that part of me, my spiritual being? My experiences, and a lot of people like me say, yeah, that's where it's all at today. That's why in the world of the Spirit it don't make sense. The problem's out here, and I tell people, go over here, and they look at me like I'm nuts. I got a guy I'm doing some work with. He comes to me. He's got all kinds of problems in many different areas. All of them sitting right out here. Job, relationships, all kinds of stuff. I said, good, well, we're going to go over here and work the steps. He looks at me like I'm crazy. The world of the Spirit is not a theory. I have to live it. I go over here and work in my right relationship with God, and all of a sudden, all this takes care of itself. Wow, that's interesting. Step 11. suggests prayer and meditation. If you don't know the difference, take a dictionary and look up what prayer is and look up what meditation. They are not the same. We should not be shy in this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using prayer constantly. Prayer works if we have the proper attitude and work at prayer. Now that's interesting. It says prayer will work if I have the proper attitude. Well, don't you think it's important to know what the proper attitude is? I know all kinds of people, AA, been in AA for years, not once asked themselves the question, you know what? I wonder what the hell the book means when it says the proper attitude. So I went and asked several people. They all told me the same thing. It's that attitude on page 55, that I sweep aside prejudice, think honestly, and search deep within me. Remember, it says, with this attitude I cannot fail. That's the attitude. See, God's world is limitless. Mine is very limited. If I close my mind, if I bring prejudice into anything I'm doing, including prayer and meditation, I just block myself off. And it also uses three words drunks hate. Work at it. I tricked the people in my home group when they asked me to chair a meeting. Here's how I tricked them. First question. Are we all in agreement that we are sober today as a result of a relationship with a loving God as we understand it? Absolutely, Mark. Couldn't be wrong. Oh, you're right on that one, buddy. And are we pretty much in agreement that every other relationship and everything else we do stems from that relationship? Yeah, we all agree with that, Mark. Good. Then here's my third question. How much time do you spend in the morning in that relationship with your loving Father? Who would like to volunteer to speak? Nobody. But then we went around, and I heard a little honesty. 10 minutes. That person later revised it to 3. I'll submit something to you, because I just went through this exercise with a good friend. He was struggling in some areas. Basically, the spirituality was taking root in him. And I asked him how much he was doing in prayer and meditation. He initially says, I'm busy, I got to go, I'll come back later. Came back and said, while I get in the shower, say hi to God and hop my car. I said, I'll tell you what, you try this for 5 days. If it doesn't work, don't do it anymore. You spend 15 minutes to a half hour in prayer and meditation, developing that relationship with God. He did. Half hour, 5 days. Everything changed overnight. Why? The book tells me why. Because in prayer and meditation, I begin to understand what it's like to operate in the world of the Spirit and operate in God's kingdom and gain access to my loving Father. And He begins to empower me, and He begins to give me ideas, and He begins to get rid of the selfishness. If I'm spending 5 or 10 minutes in meditation, that's what I'm taking out in the world all day. And by 10 o'clock, we're crazy. Right? I heard this about, oh, I could start my day over at AA anytime. That's true. Why don't you just start it in the morning? Lay your foundation. It's not necessary. What was it? How does it go sometimes? Let's see, I'm too busy. You just don't understand? Well, I don't know. Think about how much time you're spending in the morning in that relationship with God. And if your experience is like mine, which is that my entire world as I know it is derived from that relationship, consider the idea of spending a little more time with Him in the morning, and I will guarantee you awesome results during the day. Try it. Test it. If it doesn't work, call me and bitch at me. Now, I want to skip this paragraph about retired night, and I want to start with upon awakening. When I get up in the morning, I begin with, when I'm going through the work, with a set-aside prayer. I do a third-step prayer and a seven-step prayer, and then I open my book to page 86. And I go through these instructions, and I say every prayer that this asks me to pray. And then I go back, and I read all of the 10-step, and I pick up all the tools available to me from the world of the Spirit. Then I spend time just praying for people. And then I take a period of time in meditation, and my goal in the period of meditation is to get quiet and just feel and experience the presence of God. So, let's look at what it tells me. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Circle the word think and circle the word consider, because they are different. I'm going to show you how to take the work you do when we retire at night into your meditation when we get up in the morning. There's a difference between thinking about the 24 hours ahead and then considering the plans for the day. In thinking, when I've done my nightly review, if there's some stuff I got to clean up, plus I answer some questions of what God wants me to be, so when I think about the day, I think about, God, what do you want me to be? What is your vision for me in all my areas? Then I consider my plans, meaning I got to be here at 9, here at 10:30, here at 12, here at 1. Before I begin, meaning before I begin my day, here's my first prayer. I ask God to direct my thinking And I especially asked him, I think he'd be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Now look at the promise. Under these conditions, meaning having asked God in this prayer, I can employ my mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave me brains to use. My thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when my thinking is clear of wrong motives. Now I get another prayer. In thinking about my day, I may face indecision. I may not be able to determine which course to take. So in my morning meditation, if there's some things that need to make a decision, I'm now given another prayer. Here I ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. And then I relax and take it easy. I don't struggle. I'm often surprised how the right answers come after I tried this for a while. What used to be a hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that I'm going to be inspired at all times. Some of us been around AA have suffered from this next one. I might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. I absolutely know God wants me to marry this woman I met 2 days ago. He spoke very clearly to me. Says, nevertheless, I find my thinking will, as time passes, be more and more in the plane of inspiration I come to rely upon. Now I'm going to be given some more prayers. I usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer, that I be shown all through the day what my next step is to be, that I be given whatever I need to take care of such problems. Another prayer, I ask especially for freedom from self-will, and I'm careful to make no request for myself only. It says, I may ask for myself, however, if others will be helped. I had to have an elder explain that to me. Here's what it means. Mark, if you're real judgmental, you can't help others. So in your prayer, ask God to remove that part of you so that you can help people that day. That's what it means. I can ask for myself if others will be helped. If I'm being judgmental, I can't help you. If I'm in fear, I cannot help you. So I look at any areas, anything going on with me that prevents me from being of help to you. And I ask God to remove that. Says I'm careful never to pray for my own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that. It doesn't work. You can see why. If circumstances warrant, I ask wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. For some of us, the word wives is appropriate here. If I belong to a religious denomination, which requires a definite morning devotion, I tend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles that we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Let me read that again. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. Now I'm going to be given some more spiritual tools. As I go through the day, I pause when agitated or doubtful. Those are fairly constant states for alcoholics and addicts, by the way. And I ask God for the right thought or action. How many of you in here have ever asked God for the right thought? Not action, the right thought. Some of you have. I constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show, humbly saying to myself many times each day, thy will be done. That's another spiritual exercise to use all through the day. Here's the promise if I do this stuff. And they use an interesting word. They use the word danger. It says I'm then in much less danger of excitement. Think about that. Excitement is dangerous for an alcoholic and an addict. It's dangerous for us. Says, I'm then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. I become much more efficient. I do not tire so easily, for I'm not burning up energy foolishly as I did when I was trying to arrange life to suit me. This next paragraph. It works, it really does. I am undisciplined, so I let God discipline me in the simple way we just outlined. Now, turn back to page 86. We get an exercise for when we retire at night. Here's what it says. When I retire at night, I constructively review my day. Now I'm going to go through a series of questions. Was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid today? My answer for all four of this every day since I first did this work is yes. Do I owe an apology? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Have I kept something to myself which should be discussed with another person at once? And I look at that. Was I kind and loving toward all? I didn't do very well there. And I loved it. Was I kind and loving toward all? The little gal at the checkout counter that's got a stream full of people wading through. The gas station attendant. The lady at the dry cleaners. Was I kind and loving toward all? What could I have done better? Well, I spent 3 minutes in prayer and meditation. I think if I'd maybe spent a little more time like that crazy Mark talked about. What could I have done better today? Was I thinking of myself most of the time? I tell the clients this. If there was a device that measured how often you and I think of ourselves, and we woke up at 8, the thing would blow up by 9. We are so turned inward, it's absolutely incredible. Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Yeah, I did a lot of that today. Or was I thinking of what I could do for others, of what I could pack into the stream of life? Let me explain what happened in the process of doing this work. There was a time when my life was fragmented, meaning I get up in the morning and I had that life. And then I go to work and I had that life. And then I had AA and I had that life. Today, I'm involved in the stream of life. I can't tell whether I'm in AA or out in the world. Why? Because I operate in the world of the Spirit all the time, and it's all the same. Today, when I'm in recovery, I'm also in the fellowship and service. When I'm working with someone else, I'm in recovery and in the fellowship. Today, I'm involved in the stream of life. It is one continuing process based on operating from the world of the Spirit. My life is not segmented anymore. I don't have AA over here, and my job over here, and my friends over here. I operate in what's called the stream of life today. It says, but I must be careful not to drift into... Now, this is interesting. Think about this. I must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. And then it tells me why. Think about this. The reason we are worried, remorseful, or morbid reflection is we're thinking about ourselves again. And here's what it tells us. It says, because that diminishes my usefulness to others. When you walk around being worried, you are not available to help anyone else. God never intended for you and I to worry. You worry because you're operating on self-reliance. When you operate on God's reliance, you never have to worry. You're available always to help your fellow traveler on the path. Book says, Mark, don't drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Because if you do, you can't be useful and helpful. After making my nightly review, I ask God's forgiveness and I inquire what corrective measures should be taken. When I get up in the morning, I ask him the night before what corrective measures to take. That flows me right into my 10th step. When I think about my plans for the day, well, the day before, I was real short with two people and I want to go make amends to them a day. You see how it flows? I take my nightly review, get up in the morning, and I let the information that I got from that nightly review take me into this day. I operate in the world today in steps 10 and 11 based on the power given in steps 1 through 9. That's another reason I go back through the work. I can't imagine operating in 1994 based on the truth I saw in 93. I do steps 1 through 9 based on the power given to me in steps 10 and 11. I make my amends based on the power given to me in steps 10 and 11. I'm able to be of service to others based on operating in 10 and 11. 10 and 11 are two of the most powerful steps this whole program gives me. One, for operating in the world of the Spirit. Let that now be a sixth sense that I can take out here. And the 11th step for that relationship with God. Chapter 7, working with others. I said before, and this is my opinion, that virtually every problem in Alcoholics Anonymous today could be solved by good sponsorship. They devote a whole chapter in working with others. And I suspect that we're going to smash some middle-of-the-road stuff about working with others. I have the kind of sponsor who is a world trustee in Alcoholics Anonymous. He talked to me much more than I cared to hear for a long time about the traditions. And I was talking with Tom, and he talked to me about the world concepts, and that stuff is still foreign and Greek to me. But he was involved in all three parts of the program. That's the path that God took him down. He's the one through sharing all of his experience with me, gave me the tools necessary so when I sponsor someone else. I have a home group. I support that home group. I show up at all the group consciousnesses when I'm in town. I support that home group financially. I'm there to help newcomers when they come to that home group. Why? Because my sponsor pointed out to me that that was a responsibility that I had. I'm here to defend the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous till they put dirt on me. You come to a closed meeting that I'm attending and don't introduce yourself as an alcoholic or at least a desire to quit drinking, I'll ask you to leave. Why? Because that's the way he's set up. That's why. Singleness of purpose. I totally embrace and support the traditions in this program. That came to me through sponsorship. So, working with others. Practical experience shows nothing so much will ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. The word intensive is kind of interesting to look at. It says, it works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this, highlight the word this. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Please do not carry your message. On any given day, your message is like mine. It's selected parts of the big book, some of the Bible, some different books of philosophy, a little of the grapevine, and a whole bunch of my opinion. None of which will keep any of you sober. Carry this message to other alcoholics. That's why you see me and people I do work with carrying this book with us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I get a chance to work with a newcomer and they ask me questions, I'm going to go into this book so that what they hear, they see comes out of this book, not just out of my mouth. Remember the foreword of the first edition? To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered. I'll sit and talk to a new man, new woman, and I'll field questions, and I'll keep going to this book time and time again. So our responsibility is to carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they're very ill. And I love this next paragraph. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up around you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. I absolutely love that sentence, and it has been my experience. I was telling a friend of mine, there's several of you in here that I was given a chance to carry this message to, a message you'd never heard before, never been able to stay sober before, or dying of untreated alcoholism. And I look at you now, and I look at your lives, and the difference is absolutely incredible. That's the payoff for me. One drunk working with another drunk and watching that drunk's life change, watching God operate in that individual's life. That's the greatest high in the world. That's what the whole deal's all about for me. I wish to God we'd never have to do another workshop anywhere. I wish we could walk into meetings of AA everywhere across the United States and the world, and if you were new, hear the common solution in which we could absolutely agree, so we wouldn't have to do these anymore. And maybe we could get a recovery rate of 75% like it used to be. But we can't. Why? Because the message in the fellowship is not the message in the book. That's what. So I guess we're just going to keep going to these workshops for a little bit longer. Until there's more of you out there that are carrying this message. And where we can reach a place in time where we don't have to do them anymore. If you've done the work, this is the promises you get. Life takes on new meaning. You'll watch people recover. You'll see them help others. You'll watch loneliness vanish. You see a fellowship grow up around you. You'll have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Goes on to say, perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. You can easily find some by asking a few doctors, ministers, priests, or hospitals. They'll be only too glad to assist you. Do not start out as an evangelist or a reformer. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You'll be handicapped if you arouse it. Ministers and doctors are competent, and you can learn much from them if you wish. But it happens that because of your own drinking experience, you can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. So cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. Now, we're going to get a lot of instructions on working with new people. Here's the first one. When you discover a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, find out all you can about him. I go to meetings. You know what I hear from the chairperson? If you got less than 90 days, we don't want to hear anything you got to say. How in hell do I find out anything about him? Book says, Mark, you need to find out everything you can about this man or woman if you're going to help him. What are we doing telling newcomers you ain't got nothing to say? I don't understand that. Do you understand that? I don't. Gee, I wonder if that's a little bit about our pompous alcoholic egos. I don't know. I just know what the book says. If he doesn't want to stop drinking, don't waste time trying to persuade him. That's an instruction. You may spoil a later opportunity. You know, I was talking with Joe about this. We work our butts off with drunks sometimes, right? And we work and work and work and work and work. hours and hours and hours and months and, hell, sometimes years. And they go back out, and a simple case of beer does what 9,000 hours working with me could never do. That's what I think the book's trying to say. If he doesn't want to stop drinking, do not waste time trying to persuade him. If there's any indication he wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his backgrounds, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. Basically, find out everything you can about him. You need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. I need this information to determine how to talk to a new man and a new woman. That's why it's asking me. Find out all you can. I'll give you an example. If I'm dealing with somebody who's been to treatment 15 times, had a lot of periods of sobriety in and out of AA, I can assure you what they hear from me is going to be a lot different from the first time the guy's ever walked into an AA meeting in his life. It's going to be much different. That's why I think it's telling me, find out all I can, put myself in his place. Sometimes it's wise to wait till he goes on a binge. The family may object to this, but unless he's in a dangerous physical condition, it's better to risk it. Don't deal with him when he's very drunk unless he's ugly and the family needs your help. Wait for the end of a spree, or at least for a lucid interval. Then, look at this question. Then let his family or friend ask him, do you want to quit for good? And will you go to any extreme to do so? That's a question I ask people who want to do the work with me. Do you want to quit for good? And are you willing to go to any extreme to do so? I'll give you an exercise I do. It'll save you a lot of time. Separate the wheat from the chaff. Someone comes up and says, Mark, would you do the work with me? Well, I don't know. Let me give you a little exercise. Here's the exercise. Go out and buy a new big book. Read the first 164 pages. Answer these four questions in writing. When you're done, call me. First question, is this work what you want to do? Second question, why do you want to do this work? Third question, are you willing to go to any length? Fourth question, what areas are you being dishonest with yourself and others? Here's the good news about that exercise. 10 people ask you to do the work with them. At best, 2 will call you. They will not be the 2 you wish would call you. They will be the helpless, hopeless, burned-out alcoholic who needs power. That is not the one you wanted to call you. The one driving the Jag with the nice watch. It's the guy that's got his toes sticking out of his shoes, can't talk, and smells like hell. But he needs this. He needs power. You do that exercise, it'll save you tremendous time. Now, you're going to see where that exercise comes. It comes out of this book. Book's going to tell you. On the first visit, give the guy a book, ask him to read it. Go back in on the second time, ask him, are you ready to go through with the 12 steps? But when I went through that exercise, it saved a lot of time. Now, let's keep going. If he says yes, meaning he wants to quit for good and he's willing to go to any extreme to do so, then his attention should be drawn to you as a person who has recovered. Geez, there's that word again. You should be described to him as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others and who will be glad to talk to him if he cares to see you. If he doesn't want to see you, never force yourself upon him. I've never understood sponsors who call their protégés all the time. What's it say? If he doesn't want to see you, never force yourself upon him. I would like to tell you that Don cared for me so much he called me with a lot of frequency, but that would be a lie. He never called me. You know why? He knew what he had to do to stay sober. He knew I needed to learn how to do that. It's not that he loved me. It's because he did love me. He did 2 things with me all the time. He talked about God all the time, and he took me into this book. That's what he did. He made real sure that my dependency was not upon him, that it was upon God and these spiritual exercises as outlined in this book. It says, neither should the family hysterically plead with him to do anything, nor should they tell him much about you. They should wait for the end of his next drinking bout. You might place this book where he can see it in the interval. I've always enjoyed that visual, right? You sneak a book into the drunk's house, right? He comes home, he's loaded. Oh, Jesus, another big book, right? Slams the thing to the side. It keeps showing up in the counter. It says, here no specific rule can be given. The family must decide these things, but urge him not to be over-anxious, for that might spoil matters. Usually the family should not try to tell your story. When possible, avoid meeting a man through his family. Approach through a doctor or institution is a better bet. If your man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he's violent. Let the doctor, if he will, tell him he has something in the way of a solution. When your man is better, the doctor might suggest a visit from you. Though you have talked with the family, leave them out of the first discussion. Under these conditions, your prospect will see he's under no pressure. He will feel he can deal with you without being nagged by his family. Call on him while he's still jittery. See, again, this program. In the chapter 2 of the wives, they list four categories of alcoholics. You know who has the best chance? The drunk who's number 4. He's the one that's locked up in institutions, and he's been committed. In this program, the more helpless and hopeless you are when you come in, the better chance you got. It's another paradox. So, see your man alone if possible. At first, engage in general conversation. After a while, turn the talk to some phase of drinking. Tell him enough about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. If he wishes to talk, let him do so. You will thus get a better idea how you ought to proceed. If he is not communicative, give him a sketch of your drinking career up to the time you quit. But say nothing for the moment of how that was accomplished. See, what we're doing now is we're talking about the hopelessness of our disease and how we drink. If he's in a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor's caused you, being careful not to moralize or lecture. If his mood is light, tell him humorous stories of your escapades, get him to tell some of his. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Tell him how baffled you were, how you finally learned you were sick. Give him an account of the struggles you made to stop. Show him the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. We suggest you do this as we've done it in the chapter on alcoholism. If he is alcoholic, he will understand you at once. He will match your mental inconsistencies with some of his own. If you are satisfied he's a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding that first drink prevents normal functioning of the willpower. Don't at this stage refer to this book unless he has seen it and he wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand him an alcoholic, let him draw his own conclusion. If he sticks to the idea he can still control his drinking, tell him possibly he can if he's not too alcoholic. But insist if he is severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain many are doomed to never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell alcoholic patients the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. But you may talk to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, the traits of the alcoholic. If his own doctor is willing to tell him he's alcoholic, so much the better. Now, the next sentence is the only time in the book I find a word used to describe people I do the work with, and it's not pigeon, and it's not baby, and it's not that other crap I hear in AA that I believe is demeaning. Here's the word. Even though your protege, isn't that sweet? Even though your protege may not have entirely admitted his condition, he has become very curious to know how you got well. Let him ask you that question if he will. Uh-oh, squiggly lines. Tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely.
Or atheist, make it empathetic. He doesn't have to agree with your concept of God. He can choose any concept he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he'd be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he lived by spiritual principles. Now I hear an AA, oh, let's not talk about God. We might drive the newcomer off. Where is that coming from? This is pretty black and white, isn't it? About what I need to talk about. The main thing is that I tell a new guy he'd be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and he live by spiritual principles. When dealing with such a person, you better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms and conceptions about which he may already be confused. Don't raise such issues no matter what your own convictions are. Next paragraph's interesting. Your prospect may belong to a religious denomination. His religious education and training may be far superior to yours. In that case, he's going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows. But he will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked and why yours seem to work so well. He may be example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Let him see you are not there to instruct him in religion. Admit that he probably knows more about it than you do. But call to his attention the fact that whatever deepest faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. I've done the work with many men in AA who know a lot more about religion and the Bible than I ever thought of knowing. But I ask them a simple question. That's real neat that you know all that. When was the last time you got drunk or loaded? Well, 2 nights ago. Well, is it doing you much good? No, it's not. This is where the book talks to me about having to deal with that man or that woman, because they got a ton of prejudice. They know more about God. They are educated about God far beyond their capacity to understand any of it. And it's not working for them. And the book says, call to his attention the fact, however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. What good is faith and knowledge if I'm doing dope and drinking alcohol? I don't think it's any good. It's like I quote the Bible all over the page and I shoot dope in my arm. You want what I have? Well, I don't think so. See what I'm saying? It says perhaps your story will help him see he's failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. We represent no particular faith or denomination. We're dealing only with general principles common to most denominations. Outline the program of action, explaining how you made a self-appraisal, how you straightened out your past, that's amends, and why you're now endeavoring to be helpful to him. It is important for him to realize your attempt to pass this on to him plays a vital part in your own recovery. Actually, he may be helping you more than you are helping him. Make it plain that he is under no obligation to you, that you hope only he will try to help other alcoholics when he escapes his own difficulties. Suggest how important it is he place the welfare of other people ahead of his own. Make it clear he's not under pressure, that he needn't see you again if he doesn't want to. You should not be offended if he wants to call it off, for he's helped you more than you've helped him. If your talk has been sane, quiet, and full of human understanding, you perhaps made a friend. Maybe you disturbed him about the question of alcoholism. That is all to the good. The more hopeless he feels, the better. Another paradox, right? He'll be more likely to follow your suggestions. Your candidate may give reasons why he need not follow all the program. He may rebel at the thought of a drastic house cleaning, which requires discussion with other people. Do not contradict such views. Tell him you once felt as he did, but you doubt whether you would have made much progress had you not taken action. On your first visit, tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If he shows interest, lend him your copy of this book. Unless your friend wants to talk further about himself, don't wear out your welcome. Give him a chance to think it over. If you do stay, let him steer the conversation in any direction he likes. Sometimes a new man is anxious to proceed at once, and you may be tempted to let him do so. This is sometimes a mistake. If he has trouble later, he'll likely say you rushed him. You will be most successful with alcoholics if you do not exhibit any passion for crusader reform. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Simply lay out the kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. That's the 12 steps. Highlight the next sentence. Show him how they work with you. Second time the book says, I'm here to show you. Offer him friendship and fellowship. Tell him if he wants to get well, you'll do anything to help. If he is not interested in your solution, if he expects you to act only as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him until he changes his mind. This he may do after he gets hurt some more. Oh. If he is sincerely interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book in the interval. Remember the first instruction? Have him buy a new book, read the 164 pages. After doing that, he must decide for himself whether he wants to go on. He should not be pushed apart by you, his wife, or friends. If he is to find God, the desire must come from within. If he thinks he can do the job in some other way or prefers some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his own conscience. We have no monopoly on God. We merely have an approach that works with us. But point out we alcoholics have much in common, and you would like in any case to be friendly, let it go at that. Page 96, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time in any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and to be happy. To live and to be happy. To live and to be happy. One of our fellowship failed entirely with his first half dozen prospects. He often says if he had continued to work on them, he might have deprived many others who have since recovered of their chance. Next paragraph says, suppose now, Mark, you're making your second visit to a man. He's read this volume and says he is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Second visit to a man. Having had the practical experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. Let him know you're available if he wishes to make a decision and tell a story, but do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. He may be broke or homeless. If he is, you might try to help him by getting a job or give him a little financial assistance. But you should not deprive your family or creditors of money they should have. Perhaps you want to take the man into your home for a few days, but be sure to use discretion. Be certain he will be welcomed by your family. Honey, I'd like to bring this guy that's got puke all over him home for a couple days. Be certain he'll be welcomed by your family and that he's not trying to impose upon you for money, connections, or shelter. Permit that and you only harm him. You'll be making it possible for him to be insincere. You may be aiding in his destruction rather than his recovery. Never avoid these responsibilities, but be sure you're doing the right thing if you assume them. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. That's an important sentence. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the Good Samaritan every day if need be. It may mean the loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions to your business. It may mean sharing your money in your home, counseling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police courts, sanitariums, hospitals, jails, and asylums. Your telephone may jangle any time of the day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she is neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn a mattress. You may have to fight with him if he's violent. Sometimes you'll have to call a doctor and administer sedatives under the doctor's direction. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. And occasionally you're going to have to meet such conditions. We seldom allow an alcoholic to live in our homes for long at a time. It is not good for him, and it sometimes creates serious complications in a family. Though an alcoholic does not respond, there's no reason why you should neglect his family. You should continue to be friendly to them. The family should be offered your way of life. Should they accept and practice spiritual principles, there is a much better chance the head of the family will recover. And even though he continues to drink, the family will find life more bearable. For the alcoholic, type of alcoholic who's able and willing to get well, little charity in the ordinary sense of the word is needed or wanted. The men who cry for money and shelter before conking alcohol are on the wrong track. Yet we do go to great extremes to provide each other with these very things when such action warranted. This may seem inconsistent, but we think it is not. And then the next paragraph. It's not the matter of giving, it's in question, but when and how to give. That often makes the difference between failure and success. The minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistance rather than upon God. He clamors for this or that, claiming he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us have taken very hard knocks to learn this truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. Burn, I love this, burn the idea. That's a great visual, right? Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is he trust in God and clean house. That sentence sums up the 12 steps, doesn't it? Now the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such reparations as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he's living, he should proceed to put these principles into action at home. That is, if he's lucky enough to have a home. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. This next sentence is powerful. Argument and fault-finding are to be avoided like the plague. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are to be expected. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they can have a basis upon which they can meet, and little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can then be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. After they've seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to go along. These things will come to pass naturally in good time, provided, however, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate he can be sober, considerate, and helpful regardless of what anyone says or does. Huh. Of course, we all fall much below this standard many times. But we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay the penalty by a spree. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. The man should be sure of his recovery. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be in a better basis since the former did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it is to the best interest of all concerned that a couple remain apart. Obviously, no rule can be laid down. Let the alcoholic continue his program day by day. When the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. That just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. That is what my recovery has always depended on. We've seen men would get well whose families have not returned at all. We've seen others slip when the family came back too soon. I love the next paragraph. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, meaning the path of spiritual progress, remarkable things will follow. When we look back, we realize the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. When we put our lives in God's hands, the things which come to us are better than anything we could have planned. I don't know about the rest of you, but most of my wants damn near have killed me. God's never given anything to me that wasn't wonderful. My wants have almost killed me. I reached a place where I begin to understand what was said to me many years ago. Mark, anything God has in store for you is better than anything you got in store for you. Yeah, that makes sense. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world. It's the world of the Spirit, folks. A new and wonderful world. No matter what your present circumstances. You mean I can be poor and live in a new and wonderful world? You mean I can be single and live in a new and wonderful world? You mean I can have a physical handicap and live in a new and wonderful world? Yeah. When working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in the quarrels. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do. But urge upon a man's family has been a very sick person and he should be treated accordingly. You should warn against arousing resentment or jealousy. You should point out his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight. Show them he's entered upon a period of growth. Ask them to remember when they are impatient the blessed fact of his sobriety. Here's a tool. If you've been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell a newcomer's family how that was accomplished. Some of you in relationships, there's some great tapes sitting on that table that'll tell you how to take spiritual principles into relationships. If you're in a relationship and that's a struggle, go take a look at some of those. In this way, you're going to set them on the right track without being critical of them. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulties is worth any amount of criticism. Assuming we're spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things that alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid movie pictures which show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go into their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Well, our experience shows us this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. There's something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there an Eskimo would turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who sent her husband to distant places in the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield a sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We've tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there's drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, even plain ordinary whoopee parties. To a person who's had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, but it isn't. You will note we made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social business or personal reason for going to this place, or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of this place? If you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whatever seems best, but be sure you're on solid spiritual ground before you start, and that your motive in going is thoroughly good. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. But if you're shaky, you'd better work with another alcoholic instead. Why sit with a long face in places where there's drinking, sighing about the good old days? If it's a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If a business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you're with a person who wants to eat in a bar, by all means go along. Let your friends know that they're not going to change their habits on your account. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. If you do this thoroughly, a few people will ask you to drink. While you're if you get honest with them what you do when you drink, none of them will ask you to drink. But while you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now you're getting back into the social life of this world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be a maximum helpfulness to others, so never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth in such an errand. Keep on the firing line of life with these motives and God will keep you unharmed. Most of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need to carry it, green recruits, through a severe hangover. Some of us still serve it to our friends, provided they're not alcoholic. But some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue these questions. We feel each family, in the light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves.